Hi, I'm Phil Tallon, and this is Think About It, a podcast of Houston Christian University, and I'm here with Dr. Paul Sloan. Now, that name, Paul Sloan, sounds familiar. Are you any relation to the Apostle Paul, by any chance?
Yeah, named after him, actually. So.
Okay. All right, maybe a distant relation of some kind.
Check it out.
We'll follow up on that later. Now, I hear that you teach at this university, is that
correct? Yeah, that's right. Good for you to know, being my dean. I teach mostly Gospels and Paul, and some Old Testament, mostly Leviticus, and that's about it.
So one of the things I do actually know that you've been teaching for us, and one of the classes you taught for us last semester was on Jesus and the Gospels, and I think you really sort of dug into Jesus in relation to the law.
Yeah.
Now, I think this is for a lot of just Protestant Christians. They have a lot of inherited, assumptions about the relationship of kind of the, as it were, the New Testament's gospel to the Old Testament law. And so, as you're teaching students about it, what common misconceptions do you encounter?
Yeah, that's a good question. So, yeah, last semester I co-taught this course with Jason Mastin, and he was doing a lot of the textual stuff, synoptic comparisons, a lot of the other plot elements. I focused on the Jesus and the Law stuff, and most of my time in the early lectures, you have to do a bit of deconstructing work, right? You have to demonstrate to students that a lot of the kind of sort of inherited interpretations or receptions of this material is often guided by an accidental misinterpretation of Judaism itself, or just the people of Israel itself, or the nature of Jesus or Paul's critique of these people, of their kinsmen, and particularly, usually people find that they think that Jesus is critiquing legalism or Pharisaic legalism. The typical pattern of approaching this issue is to say that Jews in general, or maybe the Pharisees in particular, were legalistic. They were given the law, but they just really overdid it. You get that sort of trope that we've inherited, and then that gets coupled with some ancient evidence where you'll get a scholar like, or a historian like Josephus say, that the Pharisees are the strictest interpreters, or something like that. Mm-hmm. And so coupled with that sort of evidence, people conjure this image that the Jews of this period, in particular the Pharisees, were hyper-legalistic, attempting to earn their salvation by doing the works of the law, and so focused on minutia that they couldn't see sort of the bigger moral, ethical picture that God really wanted them to pursue, that sort of thing. So it takes a little work to deconstruct that image. I don't think it's accurate. Then once that one gets set aside, you have to do some deconstruction of other images in place of legalism. Some other scholars have said, Jews were really ethno-exclusive. They were excluding others, either because they were impure or because they were from another nation or whatever. And so that also then requires sort of doing some unpacking as to why that exclusivism wasn't really drawn along those grounds. The first one's easy to unpack. Legalism is just a caricature of the Jews of the Jesus's I'm just talking with, particularly both the Pharisees and just Jews in general and Judaism in general. None of those things are accurately described with the label legalism. And kind of one of the most basic features that falsifies that picture is the fact that God gave his people the sacrificial system when he inaugurated this covenant with them. He gave them the means through which they could experience forgiveness and atonement through the divinely prescribed sacrificial system that he gave them. It's taken for granted throughout the Old Testament. It's taken for granted in the Jewish literature of the day. Jesus refers to it. The Pharisees, of course, know well about it. So the notion that Jews or Pharisees thought they were earning their salvation is inaccurate. They recognized that God had rescued them as a people and had given them means of forgiveness and grace. And so unpacking, deconstructing a bit of that is required before you can kind of get into the positive issues of what I think is going on with Jesus and the law.
Okay, so instead of, you're trying to, as it were, repair to some degree the image of the Pharisees and people who are taking seriously the law.
Yeah.
that law doesn't equal bad, and even the sort of the Pharisees aren't these bad, these bad people. Mm-hmm, Jesus does get into a lot of conflict with the Pharisees, though. Yep. So what's that conflict about then?
Yeah, that's a great question. That is kind of the question. So what what is it then? What is his when he does have harsh words to say about some of his kinsmen, not all of them, but just some contemporary groups. What is it that he's actually critiquing? And the odd thing about it is it's really funny when you read Mark 7 or Matthew 23 or Matthew 12 or other passages like that, the explicit issue that he critiques, particularly the Pharisees for, isn't legalism or some sort of ethno-exclusivism, but transgression. He says, you guys are actually not doing the law. So the issue in Mark 7 is, they say, why don't your disciples wash their hands before they eat? And he then, after he before giving his answer in Mark 7:19 about the body's capacity to purify the foods, he has this little aside to the Pharisees where he says, you guys are great at setting aside God's commandments for the sake of your traditions. And you hold up your traditions in such a way that it results in you obviating the actual commandment of God itself. And so Jesus' issue with the Pharisees is not that they're overdoing the law, he says they're not actually doing it, according, of course, to Jesus' own interpretation. Obviously, the Pharisees would disagree with that, and maybe other Jewish groups would disagree with it. But that was Jesus' indictment, right? That you guys are transgressing it because you don't actually understand it, or either you understand it but don't actually do it, whatever it is. And so that's kind of basic to a project I'm working on right now. I'm working on a book on Jesus and the Law to come out with Baker sometime next year. And its kind of basic point is to situate Jesus' discourse about the law in more of an intramural debate, sort of Jews debating Jews about the proper keeping of the law, and that's kind of more accurately represents what I think is happening between Jesus and the Pharisees, and of course Jesus and the Sadducees, whenever that comes up, is that Jesus, in the Gospels, Jesus is presented as Israel's authoritative interpreter of what it means to be a lawkeeper, and he's stating his own position in contradistinction at times, in contradistinction to other options on the table, particularly the Pharisaic option. He thinks they're just wrong about certain issues. And so that comes up frequently in some of the episodes.
Okay. So maybe it'd be helpful to kind of dig into, a particular example where you think that, I think the common view is that Jesus is sort of there to help us to, get away from, from law observance or whatever. And this is kind of what he's doing, and this is what he helps us to do. So can you give us an example, maybe a thing about something like purity, how Jesus sort of relates to the purity laws of the Old Testament?
Yeah, that's a really good question. So a couple things there, just kind of like in the class I taught, there's some deconstruction work that has to be done first. A common misconception about purity in the Levitical, from Leviticus or Numbers or text from the Old Testament, is that it indexes a person's morality. So that impure is always a moral term. So that if you say this person is impure, you're referring to this person being in a sinful or immoral state. The language can be used that way. It can be used metaphorically to describe, some sort of sinful action. But often enough, it actually doesn't index a person's morality or a person's sinful actions, but actually just their bodily state. In other words, one's impurity doesn't actually index your morality. It indexes your mortality, so the fact that you have the kind of physical body that decays and withers. So there are a few sources of impurity named in Leviticus and Numbers, and it's corpses, animal carcasses, reproductive fluids, so seminal emissions and menstruation, and now, of course, they started naming them. I'll probably forget one. But evidences of bodily decay or transition, and so one can become impure through contact with those things or through shared airspace with those things. So, for example, if you walk into a room that's got a ceiling or in a tent, and there's a corpse in there, a human corpse, everyone in the room becomes impure just by the shared airspace. But the important part about it is that that person is not now sinful. That person doesn't now need forgiveness. He or she doesn't need to go to the temple to ask for forgiveness and say, I'm sorry, would you please, you know, forgive me? In most cases, the vast majority of cases, you just have to apply water and wait till sundown. Mm. In some cases, there are other instances where you also have to make a sacrifice or perform some sort of sacrificial, you know, act and apply it to yourself or to the temple. But in those cases, again, what the person receives is purification, not forgiveness. Lepra is the other case. It's often translated leprosy, but it probably doesn't refer to leprosy. But lepra is the other source of impurity. And so demoralizing impurity is an important step toward understanding the way it should be interpreted in the Gospels. So then to go back to your original question about sort of an instance of this in the Gospels, you might see Jesus, for example, interacting with a person with lepra and say, this person wants to be cleansed. And so he says, if you can cleanse me, please do it. And Jesus says, I'm willing, be made clean. And the lepra leaves him, and he's well. And then he says, this is where I think the mistake that people make is they say, oh, look, he's doing the job of the priest. He's subverting sort of the temple law or the law itself in taking on himself the role of the priest and in healing the guy. He's sort of subverting the priestly duty. But he doesn't, because the very next thing he says is, now, you, person I've just healed, go make the offering that Moses requires of you for your cleansing as a testimony to them, a testimony to the priests. And the point there is that it's, again, in my view, I think it's a misunderstanding of the priestly role that leads people to think that Jesus is subverting the priestly role, because priests weren't healers. Mm. Priests were never the ones responsible to heal people from lepra. They could only diagnose it and say, yep, you have it, or nope, you don't. And then once it were healed on other grounds, then they could do rituals that finished off the cleansing process. And that's what's going on in the Gospels. Jesus isn't a priest in the Levitical sense of it. And he's not cleansing the guy in the way that the priest is. He's healing the guy. And once healed, he then says, as Leviticus 14 requires, go do what Moses required of you. Lots of other examples, but that's probably enough for now.
So the pattern here is that you're by having a better understanding of basically sort of the world, the Bible, Old Testament texts, you're showing that Jesus is not subversive, as it were, of the law when he's encountering the Pharisees or what he's doing. In fact, he honors he honors the law. So I think sometimes people point to a passage like Jesus talking about coming to fulfill the law as a way of saying, like, well, if I have Jesus, then the law is like nullified in some way. That might be a common understanding that you've encountered. And the expression on your face tells me that's not the first time somebody brought that up to you. What about that?
Yeah.
So what do you say to that person? Of course, I've heard you talk about this. So
You don't buy into this atrocious view. It's common. From Matthew 5, 17 to 20, he says, don't think I came to abolish the law, I came to fulfill, etc. And then he gives what's often called the Sermon on the Mount from 5, 21 and following. And the way I often heard this sermon preached in various contexts, both actually academic and from the pulpit, was that, the Sermon on the Mount is there to is designed to make you feel shame, basically, to shame you into realizing, oh, wow, the standard is so high, I could never do that. And so then you come to the conviction that, oh, I need something else, not law-related. I need something like a Pauline grace or something. The mistake that makes, of course, is that assumes that grace isn't operative in the law itself, or that grace isn't operative in the Sermon on the Mount. I mean, Jesus is there giving, high legal standards, but is also requiring forgiveness of his people, right? He's the one saying, now, forgive this way and do this. So forgiveness is an assumed aspect of the covenantal relationship between Jesus and his disciples and God and his community and all that sort of stuff. And particularly with that issue of, I didn't come to abolish but to fulfill. The irony is that a lot of people, when they hear, oh, Jesus came to fulfill it, they interpret it to mean like, oh, he came to fulfill it on my behalf, so I don't have to, right? That sort of thing. So the irony is, it interprets Jesus to be saying, I didn't come to abolish the law by not doing it. I came to fulfill it and thereby abolish it so that you don't have to, that sort of thing. So they actually still end up sort of endorsing this abolition view by Jesus' fulfilling it. So the mistake, I think, is the stuff I've already said, that the Gospels are presenting Jesus not as sort of abdicating the law or saying that you don't have to do it. It's actually quite the opposite explicitly in Matthew, when the guy comes up to Jesus and says, what do I do to inherit eternal life? And Jesus' response is, keep the commandments. Matthew 19. The other mistake is actually just lexical. The word fulfill in that text, I think it's plerosai. When that's coupled with the word commandment, it almost always just basically means do. Mm-hmm. I came to do this. I came to do the law. Mm-hmm. And once you've got all the other pieces in the picture, on the board, as it were, it becomes plain that, like, Jesus is yes, coming to do it, but in so doing, he's also exemplifying what it means to do it so that his disciples can imitate him. Mm. And that becomes the basic thing. I mean, Jesus is telling his disciples, like, do what I do, right? Come learn from me. This is Matthew 10 or 11. Come learn from me, the end of Matthew 11. Come learn from me, place my yoke upon your shoulders, and learn from me. My yoke is easy, my burden is light. So he's not saying, come just sort of attach yourself to me so that you don't have to worry about obedience or law keeping or anything. He's actually presenting himself as the authoritative interpreter of the law itself.
Okay, that's awesome. So I take it if somebody's made it to the end of this video, they're very interested in this topic. Aside from your book coming out from Baker in a year or two, mm-hmm. what's the title?
I don't know yet. If anybody has any good ideas, you can let me know. It'll be something like I Came to Call Sinners, or How Should We Return, or something like that.
If you have suggestions for the title of Paul's book, put that in the YouTube comments below. Winner maybe gets a free copy.
Yeah, we can
do a little contest. Where else might somebody look for, if they want to just read more about this kind of thing?
Just come
study with us, too.
Yeah, come study with us. That'd be great. You can come to our classes. A recent book that came out actually also with Baker last couple of years or so is by a guy named Matthew Thiessen, and it's called, I think, Jesus and the Forces of Death, Ritual Impurity in the Synoptic Gospels, or something like that. But it covers a lot of that ground that I think is really helpful. Jesus sort of interacting in a positive way with both the law and with various degrees of impurity, including lepra. That's Jesus and the Force of Death. I'm trying to think of other good ones. I should have thought about that ahead of time. But
Jesus and the Force of Death, a great title.
It's you a good title. Some basic commentaries I'd point you to are the commentary on Leviticus by Jacob Milgram. That's going to really I think be helpful. Mm. Jonathan Kloans is another good one. He's wrote Sin and Impurity in Ancient Judaism, or Impurity and Sin in Ancient Judaism, something like that. Okay. But those are probably good resources to start with. Yeah.
Okay. If you wanna follow us on social media, you're on Twitter.
Yep.
Paul Thomas Sloan. If you want to go to our website, you can find out more about our program. So you can come survey a class or study with people like Dr. Paul Sloan. That's hc.edu/SCT, School of Christian Thought. And we'd love to get to know you as a surveyor or a student or whatever.
Nice. Thanks for having me.
Yeah.
Thanks for the conversation.
Thanks for talking.
Yeah.